Welcome to Clause 8, the voice of IP, hosted by Eli Mazur. If you missed the news at the beginning of our last episode, Clause 8 is now the official podcast of IP Watchdog. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, please subscribe on your favorite podcasting app, share it with others, and leave a 5-star rating. Finally, if you're not already a regular reader, check out IP Watchdog and sign up for the email list to get daily updates. This episode is the second part of our interview with Kevin Jaickle, the founder and CEO of Unified Patents. On this episode, we continue the conversation with Kevin about how Unified Patents operates, discuss Unified Patents' new program for targeting standard essential patents, debate whether the patent troll narrative has been overblown, talk about the patent quality problem, and delve into some other patent policy issues related to IPRs and the PTAB. We also find out what Kevin has in common with George Costanza.
So I guess one of the innovations, it seems almost like a fun thing that Unified Patent does, is that it has these contests for prior art searches, and it allows anybody to kind of participate and see what the prior art is applicable. How did that idea come about? And is that really how you do most of your searches, or is that just kind of a fun thing that you guys do?
It's a little bit of both. So one of the things that, I mean, obviously Article 1 patents, I think, you know, kind of pioneered a crowdsourcing solution for this way back in the day. We'd been very aware of it. This is not the same thing, really quite different. Like, this is just our own kind of individual contest. So we don't really rely upon it for our kind of prior art searching on the day-to-day stuff, partly because it's just not that fast.
Yeah.
And it is something where, like, if it turns out we're missing a particular element, or we're looking for kind of a needle in the haystack, and we haven't found that needle in the haystack through traditional search means, then we put it up there. We also use it to put it up there for, you know, all kinds of other stuff too. So if we just want to see if a particular patent, if there's great prior art out there, this is another way for us to do it. Generally speaking, depending on kind of what we think, we will set the value of the search at one number or another number, or depending on kind of what we're kind of feeling at the time. And ultimately, when we get good prior art, we think it's ultimately good for everyone, so we publish it to the world. So everything we get through Patrol, we publish when someone wins a award, just so that everyone and everyone who sees it can use it if they want.
I guess one last question about the operation of Unified. You said your goal is to really have the best, you know, IPR attorneys that are around. And I know you use a mix of in-house attorneys and different law firms. If you don't mind, do you mind describing how do you decide, you know, who should handle a certain IPR? Kind of like maybe an advice for somebody involved in their first IPR, how do they decide who to best use for that?
Yeah, it obviously, one of the biggest issues around doing good IPR work is the kind of technical background of the attorneys and their skill with the technology. Yeah. So first and foremost, when you're looking at a particular IPR, you definitely want to find someone who's very conversant with the technology. And sometimes that's outside counsel. Sometimes you have like a perfect fit in when it comes to in-house counsel. And sometimes patents are super broad and kind of ridiculous. And sometimes they're super narrow and hyper-technical. So the big thing that we believe in is, one, finding the right attorney for that particular IPR, and also finding the right expert who actually truly knows that technology, and then having, you know, putting those two together to come out with what we think is a superior kind of IPR product.
That makes sense. One thing, I guess, what has been the biggest, it seems, for looking outside, it seems like you've had a very successful journey with Unified Patents, but what have been, I guess, the biggest challenges that you've come across, or something that has surprised you along the way?
Surprised me along the way.
Or has it worked out exactly like you thought?
You learn a lot about yourself in a startup role. The beginning years are lean, especially if you know, we didn't take funding from anyone. So there were a couple years where we didn't, you know, make very much money. Yeah. All the, you know, myself, Brian went basically without any funding that first year, paid ourselves almost nothing at all. Then Sean Abwani joined me. We certainly weren't making as much as we used to when we first started out. That has switched over time. And every year you get a little bit further away from those lean years, you start thinking, yeah, I'd do it again. I'd start another company and do it again. But while you're going through it, it's a white knuckled, oh my God, what have I done? Yeah. I might never recover from this. So you kind of rewrite history a little bit. Every year you get further away from the lean years, you look back at the whole process more fondly. So that's my big takeaway is, for anyone else who's going to try and start something and build it up, be patient. If it's successful, you'll look back on it fondly. And if not, I'm sure it really sucks. Like it felt like it did when I was going through the thick of it.
I guess I want to talk about, obviously we talked about NPEs. More recently, Unified Patents has created zones for standard essential patents.
Yeah.
How did that idea come about? Was that part of the initial vision?
So for us, over the last kind of 3 years, standard essential patent issues at conferences and talking to companies, both members and non-members, kind of everyone. NPE litigation is significant. It's a huge distraction, but the sheer numbers around standard essential patent licensing, the like volumes and the royalty rates are such that the numbers are really, really big.
Yeah.
So we started looking at standard essential patent licensing and saying, well, is there something that Unified, is there a role Unified can do to kind of help companies, both big and small? And one of the things that we think is important is everyone should be engaged in like good faith negotiations. If they're implementing standards, then they should be engaged in good faith negotiations.
Yeah.
And one of a big part of what we decided to do with our standard essential patent areas is not just identify, you know, bad patents and try to show that portfolios are being monetized that have, you know, significant numbers of bad patents, but also provide a bunch of data to companies so that they can figure out who owns what the apportionment for any one licensor should be, and the ability to figure out the value of that portfolio to them in such a way that they can actually make a good faith counteroffer when they are approached by licensors, and do so not just by saying, here's what I'll pay, which is unfortunately what lots of companies might think a good faith offer is, but actually to make a counteroffer that is based on hard data that's got evidence behind it, and then ultimately be in a position to justify the position they took all the way through. I mean, not all that many standard essential patent litigations take place. It's kind of it's an area where there's lots of behind the scene litigation, or sorry, lots of behind the scenes licensing. But ultimately, there's a framework through which companies should be engaged in good faith negotiations. And we think that those good faith negotiations should be done, and they should be done with good, solid evidence.
I think, and I'm just talking about this as an outside observer, you think it's very sophisticated parties on both sides, the large, you know, big tech implementers and the large innovator companies. And you think that they must assume some of their patents are invalid, some of their patents are non-essential, and both parties know this, right? You know, there's no way that you have a perfect portfolio. I guess, what is your sense? Was that, did you think that was not part of the negotiations that was going on, or just not to the extent that it needs to be, or am I completely misreading the problem?
No. We're talking about large numbers of patents when it comes to standard essential patent licensing, for sure. So I guess there are a couple different ways to look at this. There are plenty of big companies that have in-house tools, in-house sophistication, in-house everything in order to manage this type of kind of sophisticated licensing issues. But there are also lots of companies who are smaller than that and don't have all those kind of internal resources, both of which are basically, when it comes to, I mean, I call them licensees and licensors, because I think that innovators and implementers is a little bit too simplistic.
Okay.
And I'm not sure it's always all that accurate. But anyway, the fact is that when it comes to licensees, whether you're big or small, everyone is doing duplicative work. I mean, this is in many ways very similar to what our NPE zones are kind of all about, which is we look at the NPE zones and say, is there a way a third party can come in and do something that individual companies or, you know, can't. We want to create like a deterrence for the whole zone when it comes to NPE activity. And when it comes to the standard essential patent stuff, we look at this and say, well, we can provide data to everyone and everyone can choose to use it or not. But there are lots of companies who engage in negotiations and probably haven't done any of the legwork because a lot of this stuff is pretty expensive when it comes to standard essential patent analysis, like who owns what and who participated in the standard and how did they participate in the standard and did they really contribute key technologies? Like, you know, there are experts and lawyers who specialize in this who are super expensive and the cost of engaging with those people can be super expensive. So there are lots of smaller companies that often don't even do some of that work, but hope that they can, you know, somehow negotiate a way to resolution. And licensors in that role are, you know, in it's something of a information advantage. They're dealing with lots and lots of licensees, collecting information from each and every one of them. And then they're able to work in such a way that they have a lot of information. And I think they're at a little bit of an advantage in terms of negotiating with people. And companies, you know, don't talk to each other for obvious reasons.
Yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I guess part of what you said, you're providing that information to the, and I want to use the right term, to the licensees. So you could provide information saying, you know, we think the licensors, you know, half of their portfolio is invalid and so forth. I guess what role do you see? I guess challenging.
No, we don't say that half. Okay. We don't tell them what patents are invalid or not.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I guess I'm curious.
I'm talking about like landscaping tools and tools for evaluating who submitted what to the standard and an economic report. This is a whole set of additional data that we do in the standard essential patent world that we don't do in the NPE world.
Yeah. But I guess I'm curious. What role does or maybe you guys don't, maybe I'm misunderstanding, but you still file IPRs in some of those standard essential patents, right?
We do in the standard essential zones as well, yes. Yeah.
And I guess I'm curious, how does that help the negotiation or I guess what is the goal with that, I guess,
Oh, yeah. So kind of two separate issues. We don't engage on the negotiations between any two companies at all. In fact, we don't know who's negotiating with who. So we are a provider of data. And we then go to work in standard essential patent zones in the same way we do in the NPE zones, which is to look at the quality of the patents out there and say, okay, are there bad patents? And if there are, we're going to show the world that some of those patents are bad so that companies and everyone is deterred from using like low quality invalid patents. And when we hope, although we don't know this to be true or not, because we're not engaged in the actual negotiation, but we do hope that all licensors who are coming to licensees and saying, hey, here are the 10 patents or 50 patents, you know, depending on the size of the portfolio, could be one or two even. Here are the patents we think are essential and you have to license them.
Yeah.
We expect the patents that get used in negotiations, we hope that everyone is raising their game. We hope everyone in those situations is using like really strong, valid patents because we don't think that every patent that's out there that's claimed essential to the standard is actually valid. And we want to go out there and show that. So we do think there's a big positive impact of ultimately doing this. And we want there to be, just like in our NPE zones, basically a downstream impact. We want everyone to be raising their game and bringing to the forefront like the highest quality patents.
And I think there's a good segue, I guess, to move on from unified patents. As fascinating as this is, I think I could discuss it all day, but to talk about the patent system as a whole, since you've started unified patents, do you think the quote unquote patent troll problem has decreased? Where do you think we stand with that, I guess, in the ecosystem?
I mean, we are still at historical highs compared to 10, 15 years ago, we are still seeing significant amounts of NPE litigation. We are down off of our high from 2012, 13. I think there was a peak in 2015, but I think that peak had a lot to do with the change in the pleading requirements, and there were a lot of filings in 2015 that got bumped forward. So we've come down off of the high, but we're still at basically kind of historical numbers in terms of the amount of NPE litigation. And so you know, I think the main factors for that are the AIA. And I think the other big one that has reduced a fair amount of that is Alice. I mean, I think that a lot of patents that had, you know, structural defects, so to speak, were, you know, there was an off ramp for kind of resolving those litigations early. And in much the same way, that meant that lots of companies who might have bought patents and asserted them, if they felt like there was any type of 101 problem, chose not to buy those patents. Or if they owned them, they chose not to assert them. So some of that litigation drop has been patents that might have been asserted in the past, but weren't because they had kind of 101 structural problems.
How about within the zones, I guess, sorry to go back to unified patents for a second, but within the zones that unified patent deters and PEs, have you seen a bigger decrease, or is that kind of trying to keep up with those NPEs? How do you think about that?
I mean, I do think we have an impact specifically in our zones. It's really hard to tell, like, anytime you're dealing with the idea of proving a negative, you don't have perfect data. Yeah. It's really very difficult to say, yeah, litigation has dropped. I would love to claim, you know, complete victory in every single area in which a litigation doesn't get filed. And yeah. I say that's because we deterred anyone from using bad patents in an area that we're engaged in. I would love to take full credit for that. I think it's always difficult to say when you're trying to prove a negative, it's all us. Like, we've raised the bar for everyone. And now the only litigations that are being filed are ones where companies have bought super high quality patents, and that's the only litigation left. You know, that's the goal. We want to get to a point where there's really, you know, everyone is only using and asserting really super high quality patents, and we don't see any type of like use of bad patents in the future. I would love to take credit for it all. I think that there's always lots of different aspects that go into it.
I guess, you know, I was looking at a presentation that you did, and you talked about the three main, I guess, companies that came out in early 2000s that were the big NPEs, which were Intellectual Ventures, Acacia, and IPNev. And then I kind of looked what happened with them. IPNev, from what I know, no longer exists. Intellectual Ventures, they had a lot of hypes, you know, articles in the New York Times Magazine and so forth. And from what I understand, many of our funds have lost money, if not all their funds. And Acacia, over the last 20 years, has only made $1.4 billion in revenue, which, you know, to compare to Intuit, for example, makes $5 billion a year. So it seems to me really small. And these are, at least from what I understand, the most well-funded and sophisticated NPEs. I guess, how do you explain that? You know, how do we have this continuing NPE activity? And doesn't this at least a bit undermine that whole quote-unquote patent troll narrative about these NPEs? Even the three biggest ones are so unsuccessful, I guess.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, since then, there have been other entities that have come forward, and now that list will look different today than it did back then. So I don't think that that's necessarily the only aspect of how you would measure kind of the NPE, I guess, narrative, as you say. But the aspect of NPE litigation, I don't think you would necessarily only look at the entities involved, but also look at the overall litigation. So there's lots of, you know, individual companies that don't happen to be the type of Acacias of the world. There's also, you know, behind the scenes, there's, I think, a big change from kind of the public sector type funding of NPE activity back in the day, Acacia and others. Nowadays, there's lots of kind of behind the scenes funding of litigation. You know, litigation funding is actually a pretty big deal in the financial markets. So there's still plenty of activity going on. And just by looking at those three companies, I don't think is a kind of an accurate way to summarize the whole NPE problem.
I guess I want to talk about, you know, patent quality. I think, you know, there is obviously some widespread agreement that all the patents that are granted aren't perfect. But I guess I'm a little bit surprised by that because, you know, you think a company, there's an inventor who's familiar with the technology field. He decides this is something new. Then you have a company that decides to spend tens of thousands of dollars getting that patent and maintaining it. You have patent examiners like yourself who are working in that technology field every day, deciding to grant that patent. Do you have an explanation? I know you mentioned, you know, examiners have limited time, but I guess, how do you explain that the patent quality problem as you see it in light of that? Or,
I mean, part of this is it's the sheer volume of applications being filed. And the difficulty of finding good prior art. And I do think that, like you said, there's widespread kind of agreement that obviously there's lots of patents that get through the system that when looked at under a microscope in litigation, we find there's existing prior art and then there is good arguments as to why they should never have been issued in the first place. So listen, I think there are solutions to this, and I think we need to take an opportunity as a industry and as like the patent bar. In many ways, you can look at it this way. Like, if you put more money up front into the system, could we get a product coming out the back end, which was more likely to be higher rates of validity than we do today? I think it's possible. Absolutely. I think that there's issues that companies could do to spend a lot more money on prior art searching and a lot more investigation because of issues around willful infringement and a whole bunch of other kind of concerns around spend for patent prosecution.
Yeah.
There's lots of problems on that front in terms of trying to figure out how do you build a patent portfolio and do so at a price point that still makes sense. Most companies rely upon the patent office to do all of the prior art searching. And you know, I think the patent office is great at searching all kinds of prior art, but there are some areas, non-patent literature being kind of one, and lots of other areas of prior art that it's really difficult for the patent office to cover all the bases. So, I mean, can we try to fix some things around that? We certainly can. One of the big questions I always ask people is, does it make financial sense to pour so much money into finding out whether or not a patent is valid up front and only issuing super, super high quality patents when a significant number of patents that come out of the USPTO, you know, never see the daylight of a courtroom?
Yeah.
And so does it make sense to have a secondary system that when a patent turns out to have some validity problems, regardless of whether or not it's unified or anyone like that? I mean, this is just a question of, do we have a very efficient system? I think our system is humming along pretty well. I actually think having a process of reviewing patents that do find their way into litigation, you know, there are plenty of patents, tons of them, that get asserted that never see a PTAB challenge.
Yeah.
Right. So we have to keep in mind that, like, everyone looking at the PTAB and saying, oh my God, there's all these, this up. What they're not counting and what they're not looking at is all the licensing activity that takes place outside of the PTAB. PTAB, just like in district court litigation, this is where we have kind of the gray areas. These are the patents where, you know, a company looked at it and decided not to license, and a patent owner looked at it and saw something different and said, you need to license it. And they couldn't come to a resolution. But there are plenty of examples of licensing activity that under those same circumstances did happen, and it never made it to the PTAB.
Yeah.
So I think the system, you know, everyone likes to complain about it, but I think the system is probably working pretty efficiently.
Well, that's good to hear. And actually, two of your, and I mentioned it before the interview, but two of your attorneys, Roshan Mansingani and Robert Jane, they wrote an interesting paper that only 20% of patents in certain district courts are challenged at the PTAB. I guess when I saw that, it kind of surprised me because you hear about how great the PTABs are at invalidating patents. And you talked about Alice and so forth, which explained some of the reasons why not. But I guess, does that surprise you that it's only 20% versus, you know, 6D or something like that?
It doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, I think this has always been true, that anytime a litigation takes place, you know, there are two parts to that litigation. One is the infringement side of it, and the other is the validity side of it. And the only time you would try and take something to the PTAB or in the past file, you know, inter partes reexamination is when, you know, you look at it and you look at the validity side of your situation and you say, I really wish there was a tool that could, you know, help show that this patent is invalid, do so at a faster, less expensive rate than it would be if we, you know, tried to go down that same path in litigation. This is purely from managing litigation as kind of an attorney. You know, previous experience of mine, this is the analysis that you go down. And depending on what you think your prior art looks like and your litigation and everything, and balancing those two between your validity arguments and your non-infringement arguments, it's not every case where an IPR is the right choice. That's just simply not the case. And there's lots of cases that settle. So, you know, those are for the right price and for the right arguments, there's a license that is potentially possible. And I think this data kind of shows that it's the PTAB is used when it's the appropriate tool. Yeah. And it would be a waste of money, I think, in every situation for you just to throw every single patent that you see into the PTAB. That's like just an unreasonable, it's an unreasonable litigation strategy.
That's interesting because, you know, I recently heard a prominent patent litigator say that there's no such thing as an invincible patent from a invalidity standpoint because you can always, especially after KSR, you can cobble some prior art together and you might find a judge or a PTA panel that that's going to buy that argument. I guess to play the devil's advocate a little bit, because before you were saying that one of the reasons we know that there's low quality patents is because of how many of them get invalidated. But isn't it possible that the PTAB or the courts are getting it wrong while, you know, the patent office was getting it right on the front end? I guess, could it be the other way that, you know, high quality patents are getting invalidated? Is there a way to kind of analyze that?
It is almost never the case that the arguments being put forth to the PTAB are exactly the same arguments that were put forth before the USPTO during prosecution and before the patent was issued. Every once in a while it happens where something was clearly missed.
Right.
But it is almost always the case that prior art was uncovered that was not before the examiner during prosecution. And now we're saying, okay, well, this was not, you know, before the USPTO, and now we want the, you know, the PTAB to say, take a look to see if this art actually does show that this patent, you know, should never have issued in the first place because this art wasn't available. I think the other piece of this is, I think the PTAB's made up of a bunch of really high quality, talented judges.
Yeah.
Many of them coming from super high quality, reputable firms. They choose to go in-house. They are individuals with both technical backgrounds and legal backgrounds. And so I think they are in a unique position to apply both their technical and legal skills to evaluate whether or not a patent is valid or not, should have ever issued in the first place. I think it's not a problem that we are looking at high quality patents that are somehow being invalidated by the PTAB. To me, that is it's kind of a crazy idea to think that that's what's happening. I mean, no one at the PTAB is saying, hey, let's intentionally try to kill high quality patents. It just, they look at the facts.
Right.
And when the facts suggest that this patent is actually invalid, whether it's a 103 argument or a 102 argument, they rule in favor of whatever they think the facts show.
And I guess a few more substantive questions, but I think it goes to that. Do you think there should be any limits in terms of how many times the same patent could be challenged by different parties?
So, sure. I mean, I think any system can be abused? I think every system can be abused. I think district court and the PTAB all can be abused. Do I think that companies are abusing the PTAB? I mean, personally, I don't. I actually think that in some cases, there's lots of prior art. Like it's, you know, you do find lots of prior art. I actually think it's really hard to get, in some cases, all the prior art you have into either a single IPR or even two or three IPRs. I think sometimes there's just that much prior art. And I think that there's an opportunity to put forth really strong arguments. Do I think that companies are abusing it? I think that in many cases, if a company files an IPR after someone else has filed an IPR,
yeah,
if the art is different and if they're not repeating the same stuff, I think they should get an opportunity to put forth their arguments. If they're repeating exactly the same arguments and exactly the same art, then, you know, I sometimes think that, okay, well, you know, they haven't done a great job coming up with something new, but I don't personally see that there's this huge problem. And I think the data shows that it actually it's a small number of patents that see lots and lots of IPRs filed against them. Most patents only see one, some see a couple, and there are a very small few that have seen lots. Now, I think those small few tend to get lots and lots of attention, but like the serial attacks on patents, I don't think the data plays out such that everyone's patent is just seeing attack after attack after attack. And I think the board has within its ability to, within its discretion, to not institute IPRs. And I think they have done that when they think they've seen a situation where companies have not come to them on a second or third IPR with arguments that are significantly different or new from what's been filed before.
Not that it's happening, but you know, theoretically, you could imagine 10 different unified patents springing up, right?
And if sure.
And if a part of a process is to deter MPs, you know, just challenging their patents over and over again kind of is a good way to do that, right? Because they'll run out of kind of funds to protect their patents. Isn't that kind of, I'm surprised it's not happening, I guess.
I actually don't think, so one foundational aspect of this is that we are not a litigation solution. So we're not going to file an IPR just because someone gets sued, whether it's a member or a non-member or whatever. Like, the strategy for doing it, that's an impossible task, by the way. And so I think that's highly unlikely. I've not heard of any like other unified patents springing up. So that what you describe right there is a litigation strategy to go after people who bring litigation. And that, I don't think anyone is pretending that that's even an option. And certainly like that's doesn't really involve anything around what Unified does. So it's a hypothetical that I hear what you're saying, but like no one's doing that.
Right.
And companies can't rely upon Unified in any way to bring an IPR on a patent that they get sued on to even attempt to achieve what you're talking about.
Right.
So we don't do that. Like no one else is doing that.
I think
that.
You alone could do that, like you said, but
Well, that's right. I mean, I certainly know we can't. And that's actually a very different litigation strategy than what we've ever set out to do. So we're not here to drain anyone of money. We're here to show that a patent that we think is a threat to our zone is there is prior art out there that shows that that patent should never have issued in the first place. And we use that to go and file an IPR. But we can't predict whether or not we're going to fit nicely into any one company's litigation strategy. Yeah. In fact, it's an impossibility for us to figure that out because we don't know what any of our members or non-members' arguments are.
Right.
Like, I mean, patent litigators are always balancing infringement and validity and they're very complex litigation strategies. We just don't know anything about what our members or non-members are doing. So we can't fit into anyone's litigation strategy. And
but not even a litigation. I was talking more of just putting pressure on these NPEs to kind of.
Well, we want NPEs to buy high quality patents. And they can do that by doing their own prior art research, by looking at the arguments. And before they buy patents, they can put lots of energy into figuring out whether or not a patent is likely to be more or less difficult to challenge on validity. It's expensive and it's hard work, but all of that is available. And actually we hope that NPEs are doing that very thing. My experience seemed to be when I was managing litigation a long time ago, companies weren't doing a whole lot of that. And a lot of really low quality patents were used against very large groups of companies. And the whole point of starting Unified was to find a way in which a third party could come in and raise the bar and deter the use of bad patents.
One last substantive question, but I want to have your take on another litigation strategy. Steve Carlson, who's a patent litigator, he recently wrote an article, Weaponizing IPRs. And he talks about a strategy that he's uncovered that some big tech companies use to force settlement. You know, they're in a litigation with a startup or something, and they threaten they don't even need to file IPRs, but they threaten, we'll go after your whole portfolio if you don't settle on favorable terms. I guess, you know, from your time in working in-house and your time obviously observing all this, are you surprised that some of these companies are using these types of aggressive approaches, using the relying on the PTAB?
Am I surprised that companies are doing that or are suggesting that that would be the case?
I mean, they're saying, well, we'll go after your portfolio if you don't.
That strategy makes, listen, being in the business of filing lots of IPRs, do that, it is not cheap. So the notion that you're going to file on lots and lots of other patents that are not in litigation is not an inexpensive endeavor. I mean, so have I heard of anyone doing it? Not off the top of my head.
Yeah.
Is it possible? The flip side of that argument is companies are always suggesting, hey, if you don't settle with me on my portfolio, I'm going to sue you on all the other patents I have in my portfolio. So, like, this is the negotiation strategies here. I don't find all that surprising. Do I believe that there have been people who've made these threats of saying, hey, we can show that lots of your portfolio is invalid? I mean, it's an expensive strategy is my first take.
I think the assumption there is that I'm not sure if they're even saying we'll show your portfolio is invalid. They're saying we're going to make this very, very difficult for you. So if you're a big tech company with endless, I guess, resources versus even an NPE probably is not going to have the same kind of resources as a...
I mean, I don't disagree with that being the case, that, you know, larger companies have deeper pockets and they can fight meritless litigations, or even cases, they can fight cases that have lots of merit. But I just don't see it as the case that lawyers are willing to file frivolous IPRs. I mean, they have their own ethical duties when they do this to not file IPRs that are meritless.
That's an interesting point, yeah.
So I don't see that anyone is going out there and saying, hey, we're just going to file an IPR because we want to try to drain you of resources. I think if I was to engage in that, it would be, I've looked at your portfolio and you want me to take a license, not only to this patent, but your whole portfolio. And I think your whole portfolio has real problems with it. And if you're going to force me to spend more money than what your portfolio is worth, I might as well spend that money to show that your portfolio is not as valuable as you'd like me to think it is. And I have the prior art and I have the arguments and I would file IPRs to prove my point. That, I think, is the appropriate one. I don't think anyone takes their ethical duties lightly when they use the PTAB. And I certainly don't see it being the case that everyone is just frivolously throwing prior art at the PTAB and hoping that they can drain companies of resources.
Two hopefully fun last questions.
Yeah.
What advice would you give to a young lawyer or law student who wants to be the next Kevin Jekyll?
Jesus. I am very fortunate to have had a very varied legal career up to this point. Started out at the patent office. I mean, you can maybe even go back before that. I was working as an engineer, getting real life experience, exposed to patent issues back then, went to the patent office. You know, I saw how the sausage was made, so to speak, then did patent prosecution, worked on what was then inter partes reexaminations back in the day. Switched over into litigation, did more inter-parties re-examinations back in the day, went to trial, you know, got all, you know, argued in court, all this good stuff, you know, to kind of form that legal foundation. Went in-house, got to basically oversee, you know, in this case, litigation from an in-house perspective, manage all the political and kind of economic issues that are involved in companies managing NPE litigation and all kinds of litigation for that matter. And it turns out that, you know, without all of those experiences, I don't think I would have been in a position to really start Unified Patents. So, you know, advice to young lawyers would be to go out there and get exposed to as many different areas of legal practice as you can. And once you've got like a strong foundation and you have experienced lots of different aspects of it, then see if we can innovate solutions, market-based solutions that helps us like evolve a better patent ecosystem. one that doesn't, you know, threaten to throw the baby out with the bathwater through other means. I think I encourage everyone to look at the patent ecosystem and see if there are ways for us to improve it for everyone.
I mean, it's just a comment. You don't see that much innovation, I guess, unified patents. So that's why it really stands out in terms of, like, you guys are doing something different that hasn't been done, before, at least from my viewpoint.
Well, sure. I mean, I don't think there are lots and lots of lawyers who are as an industry, even myself, we tend to be a little risk adverse. We tend to, you know, kind of look at the issues from a rather straightforward way. You know, we're very interested in precedent and how it applies to the current situation. So thinking outside the box and coming up with things that are truly new and kind of innovative, I think that it's something I think all of us in the legal community should really work to do. And I do think it's there's lots of opportunities to do. I run across people all the time who tell me that they thought of the idea of unified patents way before I did.
Yeah.
And just didn't do it. They just said, I just don't know if it would have worked or not. And I was like, well, you know, I mean, this is apparently they came up with the idea and they were the Kevin Jekyll before I was, but they just didn't do it. So I would suggest to you and to everyone else, there's probably lots of people out there who are coming up with innovative ideas. And in the legal community, I think we should be maybe taking more risk and seeing people do more things instead of, you know, after the fact saying, I came up with that idea, but never did anything with it.
That's great advice. Last question. Obviously, you had a varied career, but if you didn't end up following your path, or is there any career path that you think you would have liked to pursue or might still pursue since, you know, you're pretty young?
I'd like to be an architect. Yeah. I would, if maybe I would have gotten out of law and become an architect.
Okay. That's good. Like, yeah. George from
Yeah, Seinfeld. Like George, exactly. I think he what was that episode where he pretended to be the marine biologist?
Yeah.
The sea was angry that day, yeah. My friends.
I have more faith you'll actually become an architect than George. So thank you.
Thank you.